This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. Last summer, a string of 8 shark attacks along the North Carolina coast made headlines across the nation. A Camp Lejeune Marine bitten in the arm and right hand, and another man in his 60s airlifted to Greenville for multiple bites to his ribcage, hips, lower leg, and both hands. Back-to-back unprovoked attacks on Oak Island severely injured a 12-year-old girl, and then 90 minutes later, a 16-year-old boy on the same stretch of beach. Both teens' arms had to be amputated, hers at the elbow and his at the shoulder. Stories like this may make you hesitant to take a dip in the ocean this summer, but local scientists are emphasizing that shark attacks are extremely rare.
No one could have predicted last year, and we cannot use last year to predict this year.
Dr. Joel Fodry is an assistant professor at the University of North Carolina's Institute of Marine Sciences in Morehead City.
These attacks are so rare that it's harder to draw any meaningful trends. There are so many people that go swimming but never encounter a shark that it's just hard to say there's a clear set of conditions that elicit an attack.
The United States averages 19 shark attacks each year and 1 shark attack fatality every 2 years, mainly in Florida. A far more dangerous scenario involves land-based lightning strikes, which kill more than 37 people annually.
So I believe the most recent fatality in North Carolina was certainly over a decade ago. It might have even been approaching 20 years. And I believe that since records have been kept, we've had 3 fatalities in North Carolina.
Most bites that occur are possibly cases of mistaken identity, where a shark thinks they're going after a fish or sea turtle. While there is no accurate way of predicting shark attacks, scientists can learn from last summer's events. PhD candidate at East Carolina University Chuck Bangley has been studying sharks for 7 years. His dissertation work focuses on what shark species are located off our coast, as well as their environmental preferences. He says one of the most influential factors affecting their migration habits is water temperature.
It seems that we have kind of a mix of warm water and cold water sharks here. We have a lot of cooler water sharks that summer up around New England, but they come down here for the winter. And then in the summer, we get sharks that are overwintering down near Florida. So we really sit at this transition zone where at any given time of the year, there's probably at least 1 shark species around.
Since North Carolina is located at a breakpoint between northern and southern fauna, the diversity of environments and water temperature can support more than 50 shark species off our coast. Bangley says he's observed a warming trend in coastal waters over the last 5 years. He says temperatures are also heating up sooner in the spring.
Really kind of gotten warm earlier, to the point where it's kind of at almost summer temperatures by the end of May. And certainly that's what we saw last year. And we actually were catching some of our summer species a full 2 weeks to a month earlier last year than we did in 2014.
The warm coastal waters are bringing Atlantic sharp-nosed sharks and black-tip sharks into the area, along with species we typically associate with bites, like tiger and bull sharks. Scientists, including Bangley, believe a heat wave early last summer warmed coastal waters, leading to a higher concentration of sharks along North Carolina beaches. But he points out temperature is not the only factor that influences where sharks migrate.
The real big factor that seemed to come into play last year were these schools of bait fish that really piled up in the surf zone. And those bait fish migrate up at around the same time as the sharks do. And you get a lot of other species migrating along with the sharks as well. Things like dolphins and sea turtles and other large fish.
In addition, Bangley says beachgoers flock to the coast during the heat wave.
Places like Atlantic Beach, Oak Island, they were all reporting record numbers for that time of year. So you had a situation where there was probably a higher than normal concentration of sharks and other marine life in the water, and definitely a higher than normal concentration of people on the beach and also in the water.
Memorial Day, the unofficial start of the summer season, is days away. And again, sharks are making headlines. You may have seen news stories predicting another historic year for shark attacks in North Carolina. But according to Bangley and Fodry, there is no validation to this theory.
We certainly don't have experts in predicting where shark attacks will occur. We're about as good as predicting who will win a lottery as we are who will be attacked by a shark, because both are so rare.
Dr. Fodry works with sharks, inserting tracking devices on their fins to monitor their movements. He says 20 species are fairly common in North Carolina's estuaries and nearshore waters, and only a handful are capable of biting a human.
Most of those species are comprised of reasonably small individuals, 3 or 4 feet. And if you are in the water within 100 yards or 300 yards, at some point you have come certainly within that distance of one of these sharks and probably more.
While that's not the most reassuring attestation, Dr. Fodry emphasizes that the number of shark attacks in North Carolina is remarkably low when you consider the abundance of sharks along our winding 300-mile coastline.
There's this rare combination of factors that go into play that allow an interaction like an attack to happen. But over the overwhelming, the vast majority of the time, the sharks, if anything, probably try to steer clear of humans rather than key in on them.
If you're still not convinced, there are a variety of shark deterrents that use strong magnets to discourage sharks from getting close and repellents that contain the scent of a dead shark that's supposed to drive them away. But there's also common sense steps you can take to avoid a bite.
If you know there's a lot of bait in the water, be it swimming around live natural bait or bait from lots of fishing, bycatch, discards, those are factors that may draw in sharks.
Practice swimming in groups instead of alone. Refrain from excessive splashing and don't enter the water if you're bleeding. You may have heard that shiny objects or bright colored clothing can attract sharks, but Dr. Fodry says,
I think that is a better rule for things like barracuda than perhaps sharks. It is not bad advice. It makes intuitive sense, but I don't think that we have the ability to say strongly that is a major factor.
Dr. Fodry cautions swimmers to avoid water that is murky. And remember, early morning and evening are prime feeding time for sharks, so it's a good idea to stay out of the water at those times. Mosquitoes and similar pests are a major source of concern around the world, especially marshy areas like eastern North Carolina. These organisms can leave painful bite marks and harmful diseases, including yellow fever and the Zika virus. But a recent study discovered a possible link between certain pesticides, the way they're administered, and developmental delays in children. Chris Thomas has this report.
If you've got standing water or trash around your property, you may be a popular destination for mosquitoes this summer. James Gardner is director of the Vector Control Program in Pitt County.
It's very easy to go out and ride two or three blocks, and you'll find, if you're looking really hard, you'll find tires or buckets or whatever. And mosquitoes love those. That's the best breeding place in the world for them.
We reached out to a dozen counties, and of the respondents, only four, Beaufort, New Hanover, Onslow, and Pitt, have vector control programs. You may see them spraying a misty substance from their trucks in your neighborhood over the next few months. One of the more common kinds of ingredients used for pesticides are called pyrethroids, a synthetic class of chemical that's been on the consumer market for the past two decades. Pitt County uses two pyrethroid-based insecticides, Biomist 3 and 15, and Flit.
They're effective with probably the least side effects.
These programs tend to be expensive and are relatively rare on the county and municipal levels. Property owners more often apply their own treatments or contract private firms. But a recently published study pointed toward a connection between aerial applications of pyrethroid-based insecticides and the increased risk of autism spectrum disorder, or ASD, and other developmental delays in children. The study was led by Dr. Stephen D. Hicks, a pediatrician at Pennsylvania State University's Hershey Medical Center, and was inspired by a similar one done on the West Coast in 2014. At the time, Dr. Hicks was practicing at a hospital in upstate New York.
They found that a specific type of pesticides known as pyrethroids could lead to increased rates of autism, especially if they were exposed to mothers during the third trimester of their pregnancy. And we realized that that same type of pesticide, pyrethroids, were being sprayed over a swampy area near our medical center in Syracuse.
According to an outline of the study, first presented at a National Pediatrician Symposium on April 30th, Dr. Hicks and his team identified an area in central New York that administers pyrethroid pesticides aerially and compared it to surrounding areas that use earthbound methods, like the ones most commonly used in eastern North Carolina. They lined those figures up with estimates of the number of children diagnosed with disorders on the autism spectrum and other developmental delays. The results? an increased risk of ASD when exposed to pyrethroid pesticides from aerial application.
I honestly was a bit surprised that we were able to replicate some of the findings of that previous large study. Not so much because I didn't believe their results, but because I wasn't confident that the power of our study would allow us to see statistically significant differences.
The study's outline did not specify why aerial applications seem to have this effect, only that there seems to be a correlation between it and developmental delay in children. Dr. Hicks advises caution on the part of the general public upon hearing the results of the study. It is the first of several planned throughout the nation, and should not be considered a magic key that opens the still-confounding lock facing the autism spectrum disorder community. That key, or keys, may not be found for a while yet, since disorders on the spectrum vary immensely.
I think that unlike many of the monogenic disorders that are out there, that is, diseases caused by a single gene change, there are a lot of genes that are implicated in autism. They account for about 50% of autism cases, but there's also cases out there without a genetic explanation.
Furthermore, the study didn't find a connection between pregnancy term and exposure to pyrethroids. Dr. Hicks stresses that it isn't a particular kind of pyrethroid, but the way in which it's administered, aerially, that makes the difference. It is not a common method throughout the state, including eastern North Carolina. His suggestion to concerned individuals? Don't panic.
These results are preliminary, and they're not sufficient yet to cause major changes to public health policy.
Depending on a number of factors, including rainfall, mosquito spraying will continue from now until the end of the summer, and perhaps into autumn in eastern North Carolina. Mr. Gardner, Pitt County's vector control director, said he wasn't familiar with the study and declined to comment on it, but offered several suggestions to lessen the effect of mosquito bites.
The biggest thing that most people can do is do a survey of their yard, find where mosquitoes may breed, and eliminate that source if possible. If not, there are some products on the market. You know, if someone has water that cannot be dumped, or they want to use it for their garden or whatever.
Mosquitoes, and the pesticides used to control their population, are a source of concern the world over, and rightfully so. But with new scientific discoveries made about both attracting headlines, it's important to remember responsible scientific studies almost always take lots of time, decades in some cases, and numerous trials in a variety of environments. The study done in upstate New York is an initial one, and shows, for now, correlation, not causation. For Public Radio East, I'm Chris Thomas.
Bring your jacket and umbrella out to the 28th Annual Beaufort Music Festival, happening in downtown Beaufort this Friday and Saturday. Mac McKee speaks with one of the festival organizers, Sarah Phillips, about this free event.
The Beaufort Music Festival is not only popular, it's a massive event. What area of town will the festival cover?
Yeah, it is a massive undertaking each year. So we are located right in downtown Beaufort, North Carolina. So we're in actually two spots this year. We're on the Beaufort Historic Site, which is located right on Turner Street. That's kind of the heart of downtown Beaufort. That is on Friday. We have a big stage there on the Historic Site area on Friday evening. And then on Saturday, we're actually moving out a little bit and having our stage on the Historic Site as well as Middle Lane and town parking lot on the other side of Middle Lane. So it'll be a little bit wider area on Saturday.
Now, how will parking be handled for the event?
So parking is going to be a little bit of an issue in Beaufort. There are so many different events happening in Beaufort this weekend. We're partnering with a lot of those events to offer shuttles up and down Front Street. So usually people can park anywhere along Front Street and catch a ride on one of these shuttles that kind of go back and forth. Also near the historic site and near the downtown area, there is a lot of parking on Front Street. And then there are a lot of other spots. You know, the Maritime Museum is nearby, and there's parking there. There are a lot of churches and church parking lots around the area, and there's always street parking.
Sarah, in the event of rain, what are some of the alternate venues?
Yeah, looking at the weather forecast is a little bit disheartening, but we are going on as planned, rain or shine. We have already rented quite a few big tents for both sites, so we'll have most of the areas covered with tents. All of the bands will be covered totally on the stage, so people can watch the bands and not worry about getting wet.
Now, in 2 days, there will be a total of 17 bands performing. Who are some of the can't-miss acts for Friday?
Yeah, we're really excited. This is the most bands that we've ever had at the Beaufort Music Festival. I think having one stage on Friday and then two stages on Saturday is a really great way to do this. So for Friday, there's a couple of people that have been here in the past. Kudubai is a local band. They've been playing for about 5 or 6 years now. They've kind of created a following. Rebecca Todd and the Odyssey is the second band in that lineup, and they're from not too far away in the Chapel Hill, Durham, Raleigh area. The Mid-Atlantic is actually one of my favorite bands. They're from Wilmington. They're super high energy, a lot of really great fiddle and bluegrass kind of sound. And then the AJ Gent Band, they're from Atlanta, and that's going to be the headliner, and they start right at 9 o'clock on Friday night.
And who are some of the can't-miss acts for Saturday for the Beaufort Music Festival, Sarah?
Saturday is going to be hard to choose because there are two different stages, and we have six or seven or eight bands on each stage starting at 11 o'clock in the morning. So the exciting bands, I think, the Low Counts are a band that has been at the music festival two times already. They are a local favorite. They're from west of Raleigh, and they just, it's two guys, one on drums, one on guitar, and they just have an amazing big sound. So they're going to be really popular. They start at 3:30 on Saturday. And then something that has gained a lot of attention is an all-female mariachi band that we are getting from New York. They have gotten pretty big over the past few months, so we were really lucky to get them when we did. They have a great sound, authentic costumes, great music, so they're going to be really exciting to see. And then we do have a couple of people that have been before, so the Tan and Sober Gentlemen from Chapel Hill, they played last year. And also L-Shaped Lot. L-Shaped Lot is a band from Wilmington, and they have played in Beaufort and in surrounding towns for probably 10 years. I've seen them a dozen times or more, and so they are really comfortable playing in this type of environment and have a really great local following.
What other family fun events do you have planned when folks want to take a music break?
Yeah, so it's going to be, Saturday especially, is going to be really exciting. Friday is just in the afternoon, but Friday is going to be a full day of events. And as I said, rain or shine, we'll have things going on. So we actually are on Saturday going to have food trucks. So we have a couple of different food options so people don't have to try to find food. And then we also have a kids area from 2 o'clock to 5 o'clock, and there are going to be activities and hula hooping and crafts and art. And then we also have two separate beer gardens. So as you probably know, this festival is not free to organize. We have to pay the bands and pay everything else. So having beer and those sales, 100% of those profits go directly to paying the bands. And so the beer gardens have been our one of our main ways to help pay for the festival.
Public Radio East is a media sponsor for the 28th Annual Beaufort Music Festival. And for more information, please go to the PRE events calendar. Sarah, thank you so much for being our guest today on the Down East Journal.
Thank you.
I was asked to start a program at Public Radio East called Vocal Treat. I actually helped do some of the fundraisers. I learned how hard it was to raise that money. And so I became first just a regular donor, and then over the years we just kept increasing our pledge. I really love just about everything, and at home probably have it on about 3/4 of the time. And we listen. It wakes us up in the morning. It's our constant companion. It really is. If you listen, then you should be supporting Public Radio East. Obviously means a lot to you. You should be donating, so we need to be the supporters. I do know there are many, many times when I just can't leave my car. That says so much about what you guys do. If it wasn't so interesting, if it wasn't so compelling, you could just turn off the car and walk away. But you can't. You have to hear the rest of the story. I am Pat Rowlett. I live in New Bern, North Carolina, and I am Public Radio East.
This is Lisa Rayburn, horticulture agent with Onslow County Cooperative Extension, here with this week's edition of The Garden Journal. This week, I want to talk about landscape design for small spaces. As time goes on, home lawns are getting smaller and smaller. It used to be that homes typically were on an acre lot, but that's not really the norm anymore. And as we get older, I'm not really sure we want gardens that are that large anyway. It can be a lot to keep up with. But if you have a gardener spirit, it can be difficult to give up precious growing space. Whether your interest is flowers, shrubs, or veggies, it isn't easy to decide which plant to leave out of the garden. But you can do a lot with a small space. You just might need to look at things a little bit differently. One of the first things to think about is looking vertically. Vines of all kinds can give wonderful color and texture to a garden, whether they're ornamental or edible. When planted in containers, plants are mobile, which means they can become even more versatile. Think of a shade for a hot summer's day, or even a wind or noise barrier. When trying to design for a small area, remember that upright and columnar plants can give the illusion of space. Using plants with a variety of leaf sizes and textures makes a bold statement as well, and gives the impression of more space than is actually there. Try to include interesting visual elements, such as paving stones or boardwalks, to break up open areas into smaller individual spaces. Try to have one or two destinations in the landscape with a path leading to them, such as a sitting area, or perhaps a small water feature with a bench or a swing. This gives visitors a place to go, and with a destination in sight, the walk through the garden will seem longer. You can throw in some interesting design elements along the way, such as unusual containers or a piece of artwork, like a simple sculpture. These distractions will keep the eye moving from place to place and give the feeling of a much larger space. Color is also a great way to make a garden feel bigger. Bold colors catch our attention initially, making the remaining landscape recede in the distance, and thereby giving the illusion of space. The use of dwarf plants is another way to save space. Take advantage of a wall or a structure by using some espalier plants. These plants are carefully pruned into two dimensions, so they sit flat up against the wall. They don't take up much room and certainly give an interesting look to a growing shrub or tree. This is also a great way to manage fruit plants, like figs or pears. Trellis plants can also be a delightful surprise and add architectural interest to the landscape while using space very efficiently. Finally, look for plants that serve multiple purposes. Many edible plants can also be very attractive in the landscape. A grapevine can serve both an ornamental purpose and provide fruit in the yard. One variety to look for is Old Home. It has a decorative leaf that's shaped kind of like a maple leaf, as well as producing tasty fruit in the fall. Other edible plants can serve double duty. Blueberry bushes are attractive shrubs, providing white flowers in the spring, beautiful foliage through the summer, and attractive red twigs during the winter months. A downsized garden can give just as much pleasure as a large one, and maybe more because there's less maintenance to do. Downsizing might take a little bit more planning, but isn't that half of the fun?
The 9th annual Crystal Coast Boat Show takes place on the Moorhead City waterfront this weekend. In addition to new and used boats on display, a car show, art events, and children's activities are planned.
My name is Tom Kies, and I am the director of Downtown Moorhead City Revitalization Association. We have more vendors and exhibitors than we've ever had in the past. We have 26 boat dealers and marinas who are going to be showing close to 100 boats in water and on land. They range in size from as small as about 12 feet long up to over 50 feet. And we have about 40 vendors that are going to be throughout the waterfront area. We have an outrageous art show that's going to be taking place on Saturday. We have an antique auto show. And on Sunday, the After Hours Rotary Club has a regional cornhole tournament. Everybody should find something that's going to be of interest. It costs absolutely nothing. It's free to the public to get into the Crystal Coast Boat Show. The sailing event itself is put on by a nonprofit, and they're giving free rides. And in some cases, they'll even teach you how to sail, and they do that all for free. The 9th Annual Crystal Coast Boat Show takes place on Saturday and Sunday, May 21st and 22nd, in downtown Morehead City on the waterfront. For more information on this nonprofit event, go to publicradioeast.org, events calendar.
Thanks for listening to the Down East Journal. If you have questions, comments, or ideas, drop us a line at publicradioeast.org. Have a nice weekend.